Judiciary Committee. We apologize for our late start, and we'll try to move through the agenda as expeditiously as possible. I think simply because we're still waiting for a few committee members to show up, we're going to adjust the agenda slightly, and I'm going to go ahead and start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 611. And so I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 611 at this time and invite up Cindy Robert and John Baker.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I am privileged to represent the American Institute of Architects. I have with me today John Baker, who is our legislative co-chair, is on our board of directors, is a national regional director, and also happens to be an attorney. I also have with me about 15 architects, some of whom have spoken to each of you about the bill we're talking about today, but I'm happy to have them in the Capitol and encourage their involvement in the legislative process. Senate Bill 611, which you have before you, is not aimed at trial attorneys, as some might have thought at first. And actually, we had the fortunate situation where we were able to sit down with the trial attorneys in the Senate and come up with some compromises that allow this to be a bill that simply makes it so that if you're going to file a claim against an architect, engineer, land surveyor, or other design professional, you first must, your lawyer must first talk with another design professional and ascertain that there is some reason that there may have been a breach of the standard of care. You'll see on the first page that I've given you some cross-references to Oregon rules of civil procedure and where we're getting the language for the statute. The only change we're really making is we're setting this process out a little bit earlier for the design professional, and that's mostly because of the rising cost of construction insurance. That's where this is aimed, is the prices we're having to pay for insurance in the construction industry. There's been two other bills this session that also arose out of the interim that deal with that aspect. I think you've heard one of those, and it's moved forward, and now we have this one before you. This bill did pass the Senate Judiciary Committee after negotiations, extensive negotiations, unanimously, and passed the Senate floor 28-1. I think that I'll tell you what's in your packet so you know what's here, and then I'll have John Baker answer questions or bring out more detail exactly what the Certificate of Merit is. The one thing I will say, and I know this is a term that you're all familiar with, so I certainly don't need to explain it, but the one thing I will say is the difference we think between lawsuits in the construction industry against us and someone like a contractor is that the actual construction defect most of the time is evidence in and of itself of a problem that requires some kind of suit. Whereas with us, we're more on the esoteric end, we're on the design front, and what we do is not as tangible. So we hope that by doing this, we'll have attorneys who are required to look into these kind of professional design opinions. We'll have them do it more readily as it's required, and suits can be dismissed because of it. Also within your packet is the Certificate of Merit opinion sheet, which you've all already been given. The Certificate of Merit issue be from the National AIA. I should tell you also that Marshall Cobo with the engineers is our co-sponsor of this bill, and this affects them obviously in the same way that it affects us, but in the interest of your time, I think the architects will just do the testimony for both of us today. Also attached are the seven other states that have some form of Certificate of Merit bill. You'll notice that two of those are merely medical, which is a huge, huge bit, but they're medical Certificate of Merit. The others are specific to design professionals, which is what we're doing today. And the last one is a study of professional liability claim against architecture and consulting engineer firms, which was a 10-year study. It's a little out of date, but it still brings home the point that a lot of times we're being brought into lawsuits needlessly, and our insurance companies are settling to get us out, and it's making the price of our insurance more expensive and making the price of us doing business more expensive.
Thank you, Cindy. Mr. Baker?
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think Cindy's covered most of it pretty well. I think it's important to highlight the fact that this doesn't change the design professional's responsibility or liability in general to the community or to their clients. The liability and the scope of responsibility of the undertaking remains the same. This only is designed to sort out frivolous lawsuits before they turn into expensive frivolous lawsuits, which are either settled for nominal amounts after expending defense costs that are usually borne by the design professional themselves under the deductibles under their policies, that those costs are borne as direct expenses before there's a resolution of this. This bill proposes no new proceedings, and it proposes no new pleadings or filings. It's simply a certification of that the party, through its attorney, has got the evidence, has done the homework that it will have to have done if there were a summary judgment motion made against that pleading later. Exactly the same certification is the certification that would withstand a summary judgment motion. This simply says that we are not going to have ready, fire, aim litigation, usually with respect to third-party claims in Oregon, but that it's going to be ready, aim, fire before one brings in the design professionals into a litigation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Baker. Are there questions for either Ms. Robert or Mr. Baker about the bill? Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Baker, it might be helpful for you to put some numbers to that you had shared with me previously about what it costs typically for a design professional to get extricated from a lawsuit, and even when there's no merit to the claim that's brought against them.
Certainly. In my experience, which is what these numbers are based upon, it costs between $15,000 to $25,000 to get extricated from one of these litigations, either by going through the judicial proceedings that are necessary to have the case dismissed, or through the negotiation process to settle with the claimant, who essentially will accept a fairly small number, but the amount of time and the amount of distress that one undertakes is in that range. The deductibles that design professionals need to carry, and those deductibles are probably going to continue to go up right now because design professional insurance is becoming more difficult to get and the coverage is becoming more restricted as the insurance markets continue to harden, is generally borne out of pocket to the first $10,000 to $15,000. Then the rest of it is borne out of insurance. It, in my experience, takes about 60 days to 90 days to get rid of one of these things when the suit is filed, without any investigation having been done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative McPherson. Did you have something to add, Ms. Robert?
Mr. Chair, I implore you to not make it look so easy to get my work done here. I have 20 of my clients behind me.
All right, guys, start asking tougher questions.
Mr. Chair, I actually do want to add two things. It was previously asked, and perhaps you've had the same question, by Representative Shetterly, whether this had any impact on the statute of limitations. And actually, the way this legislation was written, it assures that if for some reason you have not made this call to another design professional, that and the statute of limitations is about to run out, you can still file the claim even without this certification and supply it later. That first of all. Second of all, it had also been brought up by several of you during meetings with architects and engineers in the past couple of days. Well, how do we keep this from applying to others? And you should know that when we drafted this legislation, we put it into a place in statute, and I don't see it referred to here, but it's 30.785, which was specific to liability of an architect and engineer. So we envisioned drafting it very narrowly to the design professional.
And Cindy, you indicated at the beginning of your testimony that when this bill was on the Senate side, you negotiated with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and others who had concerns about the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And you worked those out on the Senate side. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we were able to do that. And very briefly, I know you folks are very busy, but very briefly, what we did is we limited the requirement for a certificate of merit to those people who normally would have the kind of information needed to take to a professional and say, has there been a breach of standard of care? 75% of the cases brought against architects and engineers are brought by the construction contractor, the subcontractors, the owners, the developers. So the cases would affect them. When it came to your outside party, a personal injury case, they would not be required to certify that this has been done. And that was the amendment that was made, Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell, I can always count on you for a question.
Well, if you need one, yes. I always do my best, Mr. Chair. excuse me, Cindy. In the backup material that you've given us, there's a number of states that do have this type of legislation in place. And in some of the other states where it has been extended to other professions as well, has it proven to be pretty effective and pretty useful, sort of across the board, or is this something that really only works well for engineers and architects?
Representative Crummell, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that's all from the point that you're standing at. I think that a lot of professionals would like to see this kind of certainty to cases that are brought before them, but I think that we're in a unique situation. Other states that have reflected our legislation, three of them are as narrow as the design professional. One is any kind of licensed professional, and the other ones are strictly limited to medical liability. So I'm not sure where the strength behind each of those has come. I assume it's from those professionals. Seems to me that the one that would be easiest to implement and adhere to would be ones with the design professional, because we, are not dealing with the tangible. We're dealing with a concept, and that's where this works best for us. But that is how we compare to other states. Representative Crummell, it's also interesting to note that in Arizona, where they have this legislation, they're doing the exact opposite of us, whereas we're keeping it so that the cases can only be brought by the others in the construction industry. The certificate of merit is only required for personal injury cases in that state. So we're learning from them all. And that was actually pointed out by the trial attorneys, who were very helpful in trying to figure out how to do a carve-out that worked.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Did you have anyone else, Cindy, that you wanted to testify?
Mr. Chair, I know you're busy, so we'll let you get on with your business.
Thank you very much. Other than people who did sign up, is there anyone else here on Senate Bill 611? Right. Hearing them, then we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session.
Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I move Senate Bill 611 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Are there dash four amendments?
There are dash fours. I think those were discussed or not.
Weren't those Senate dash fours?
Oh, they are. I apologize.
Right. So Representative McPherson's motion is to move Senate Bill 611 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crumbly.
I will just point out, and I understand the scope of this bill, and am not trying to, would not try to poison it in any way, and am not interested in trying to add anything to the present bill under consideration. But I think that as we are moving towards some of the things in medical malpractice, that this is certainly a concept that deserves a look in that arena. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Anybody else? Okay. Nancy, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Parker.
Aye.
Nansen.
Aye.
Carmel.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Zonsky.
Aye.
Natalie.
Excused.
Aye.
Senate Bill 611 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer carrier, Representative McPherson, is assigned the bill. Do the architects want to leave now or stick around? A discussion about SAFE.
Now the fun's on.
And by the way, she did all our hard work beforehand, so you just need to know that.
This is how you make sure there's really 20 of us out there.
Right.
impressive.
I counted 22, Mr. Chairman. Can we reconsider that vote?
You really do know how to clear a room.
Obviously, those who are on the groom's side. Once they determined who they were sitting next to.
They all left.
All right. We are now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3630. And for those who... I think everybody generally knows that 3630 is committee a vehicle that was in the committee's possession, which is going to be useful for the purpose of potentially having amendments made to it that would put into effect the discussion that the committee had several weeks ago about the possibility of some blending of a mechanism involving SAFE to provide some relief on malpractice insurance rates to certain categories of doctors. And that's what this discussion, I think, today is going to be about. So we have a number of people signed up to testify, and I'm going to start by bringing up Ms. Streisinger. And do you have an initial panel that you want to bring with you, Corey?
Well, I was going to say that I have 20 people sitting in the audience.
Right.
But I can't do that. I don't think so. I think the other individuals have signed up to testify one by one.
Okay, good.
And I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I am here today to testify on the proposed Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3630, which would implement the governor's proposal to reduce professional liability insurance premiums for rural doctors. And for those of you who may have seen the Dash 1 amendments, there aren't substantive changes between the Dash 1 and the Dash 3. The Dash 3 includes some language that was inadvertently omitted from the Dash 1 and also tightens up the study section of the bill, but substantively they're very similar. The committee has spent many hours over the past month studying the problems caused by the high cost of medical professional liability insurance. And I know you've looked at many proposals for lowering those costs, and I think a lot of people in this room would agree that there aren't any easy answers. I wish that I could be here before you presenting a global, long-term solution to the problem, but unfortunately that is not what I can do today. The proposal that we have before you is short-term and a partial response, but we do think that it's an important first step and worthy of going forward with. This proposal would reduce insurance costs by offering low-cost reinsurance. The reinsurance would be offered by SAFE. The program would be for the benefit of doctors in rural areas where access to medical services is most at risk, and it would be aimed at those specialties where insurance costs are the highest. So doctors eligible for the program would be those in rural areas, specifically obstetricians, family practitioners who offer obstetric care, neurosurgeons, and trauma doctors. And I believe you've heard testimony earlier this session from a number of doctors in those fields, and they've told you that insurance rates can range up to $50,000 or $60,000 per year. The definition of rural that's incorporated in the bill is that used by the Office of Rural Health for purposes of the tax credit available to rural doctors. I believe Karen Whitaker from the Office of Rural Health is here today and will talk about some of the definitions of rural, among other things. Under that definition, rural is an area that's at least 10 miles away from a population center of 30,000 or more. And a doctor is considered to have a rural practice if at least 60% of his or her time is spent practicing in those areas. Essentially, what that means is the vast majority of the geography of Oregon is considered rural outside of the metropolitan areas between Portland and Salem. In addition, that under that definition, Bend and Medford are not considered rural. There are some other definitions that exist that we've been looking at, and this is one of the areas, and I know there are many, which we expect will get further discussion. We are also proposing an income test for eligibility for doctors receiving this reinsurance to ensure that the program benefits those who need it most. And you will see in the Dash 3 amendments there is a blank in that section of the bill. We are gathering views from those in the profession about what an appropriate income test would be, and we do hope to have a recommendation for you very soon. As I mentioned, the reinsurance under this program would be provided by SAFE. So the insurance would continue to be provided through the existing primary carriers. Doctors would purchase their insurance from the same place they buy it today, but the reinsurance provided by SAFE would, we believe, reduce the costs for those primary insurance carriers. And the Dash 3 amendments would require the savings then to be passed along to the doctors purchasing the insurance. The cost of the program would be capped at $10 million per year, and we would expect this to result in a premium reduction for those doctors of at least 50%, and we think quite a bit more. The Dash 3 amendments don't set out the details of the reinsurance program to be offered by SAFE, because the details would have to be worked out by SAFE based on the market and also negotiations between SAFE and the primary carriers. So the Dash 3 amendments, the structure of the Dash 3 amendments, that would require SAFE to submit a plan for providing this reinsurance. That plan would then be subject to approval by my department under the standards that are set out in the bill, and the goal would be to have the insurance available January 2004. As I mentioned, the program cost would be capped at $10 million per year, and SAFE would be entitled to offset its cost against the assessment which it pays to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This assessment is paid by all workers' comp insurance carriers and self-insured employers. It's currently equal to 8% of workers' compensation premiums. It goes into a premium assessment operating account, which funds the administration of our workers' compensation and OSHA programs. And for a number of reasons, collections have been higher than projected in that account. So we are, in fact, planning to decrease that assessment. We did report to the Ways and Means Committee that we were anticipating a decrease from the current 8% down to 6.7%, and we expect to be able to implement that rate decrease even with the offset for SAFE's costs in this program. We are proposing that the reinsurance program continue for 4 years, and during that period, we want to look at several longer-term options for solutions to the problem of high-cost medical professional liability insurance. We also want to look more in depth at issues relating to access to rural health care. So in the Dash 3 amendments, we are proposing three separate studies, different aspects of this problem. First, we'd like to look at different insurance mechanisms which may be helpful in dealing with these rates. The legislature has looked at the issue of high insurance costs before in other contexts, and our current statutes contain a number of provisions for insurance mechanisms, such as market assistance plans, joint underwriting agreements, excess liability funds, professional liability funds, and so on. And none of these mechanisms is currently in use in the area of medical professional liability insurance. We'd like to look at those mechanisms to see whether any of them can be made to help in this particular area, and that might be with or without external funding sources. Secondly, we do want to look at the concept of a no-fault system to provide compensation and cost of care for what are sometimes called bad outcome births. And I think you've received testimony on a similar concept before. We don't have a specific concept here, but rather think that the area is one that deserves study. Only a fraction of these cases today end up in the tort system. The costs of care for other infants who are going to perhaps need lifetime care are picked up somewhere else in our health care system, maybe by the parents' employer-provided insurance, maybe by a government program, and we'd like to take a look at whether there's a better way to provide this compensation outside the confines of the tort system. The third look that we are proposing would be a more broad look at access to rural health care generally. This would not be limited to insurance issues, but would look at a whole range of factors that affect access to health care. And under the Dash 3 amendments, the Office of Rural Health at OHSU and the Office of Health Policy and Research would be asked to work on that issue. I do want to stress, because I know this is a concern to some of the others with an interest in this topic, that in proposing these studies, we don't mean to suggest that these are the only areas relevant to a discussion of insurance rates. As you know, a task force during the last interim surveyed a range of proposals to address this issue, And although they were not asked to reach consensus, the report surfaced quite a number of ideas in a broad range of areas, including tort reform and patient safety, as well as insurance concepts. This committee has looked at a number of the proposals that came out of that task force work, as well as other proposals, and I'm sure that similar proposals will be on the table during future legislative sessions as well. Any studies we do in the interim won't change that, won't limit the areas for consideration, but we do believe that in some particular areas, the expertise in our insurance division can be helpful in gathering data and perhaps looking at some proposals in different ways, and we do think that through these studies we can perhaps help do that. So that's essentially the summary of the Dash 3 amendments. We do hope for your support for this proposal, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Streisinger? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned further discussion relating to the rural designation. I represent an area that has 76,000 people in the county. We happen to be 25 miles from Medford, which would put us outside the area of being rural, and yet we've gone from 12 family practice and obstetricians to two. That's not a very good, it didn't give us a very good ability to serve pregnant mothers. So I would like to know any flexibility you have on that 25-mile radius.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, actually I believe the current definition is 10 miles outside of a population center of 30,000, so an area 25 miles away from Medford would in fact be included.
Wasn't it originally at 25?
I believe that the definition that the Office of Rural Health uses is 10 miles. And Karen Whitaker, maybe we could ask Karen Whitaker to come up briefly and address that.
I've got her next on the list,
okay.
So we'll have her respond to those questions, won't you?
In addition, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there are a number of other definitions, and we're certainly happy to look at other definitions of rural that people want to put in front of us.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
I'm just following it a little on the same thing, and I'm probably misunderstood. But I thought I understood initially that the area of Portland-Salem and then Medford and Bend area were non-rural, but were considered population centered. I want to make sure that this, are we considering Eugene in the rural?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I misspoke and I apologize. Eugene would not be considered rural. The map does, the rural, the urban areas on the map essentially are the circles around the population centers in the valley plus Bend and Medford, and I did misspeak. And since I came from Eugene, I grew up in Eugene, I'm particularly embarrassed to mention that.
Trying to get them up.
Well, you know, I grew up in a rural area outside of Eugene. How's that?
Further questions for Ms. Streisinger? All right. Thank you very much, Corey. If you want to, it might be helpful to have you stay when we bring up the next two witnesses. Why don't we have Karen Whitaker and Catherine Keene both come forward now, if they would please. Do you have a preference of which one of you wants to go first? Okay. Ms. Whitaker.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the Center for Rural Health at Oregon Health and Science University, and that also includes the State Office of Rural Health within that center. I'm very pleased to join you today, and I commend you and our governor for considering and proposing House Bill 3630. Many of you are certainly already aware, because you've been hearing testimony throughout the session, that many areas of our state do not have adequate access to primary and obstetrical care, and that rural health systems are fragile and the healthcare workforce in rural areas of the state is not stable. And the precipitous increase in professional liability insurance premiums has contributed to an even more serious situation in many communities. And there's been, of course, widespread media attention to this issue as well. House Bill 3630 is a promising step in the direction of addressing this issue, and I think we can all appreciate the precision with which it has been crafted, targeting the most vulnerable areas of the state. I know there has been some question about how these rural areas are defined, and so I have come today prepared to discuss with you the various generally accepted definitions of rural and why our office has chosen the one that it uses. And I have attached in the folder that you have before you a number of maps, and I'm just going to walk you through these quickly and explain to you what the various generally accepted definitions of rural are. And the first one that you have in your packet is based on the U.S. Census Bureau's definition of rural. And it actually has three different categories. It has urbanized areas, urban clusters, and then rural areas. And they define rural as everything that's not urban. So first we have to go and look at what urban is. And in the that makes sense, doesn't it? So in the map before you, the dark brown areas on the map are urbanized areas, and they are pretty much what Ms. Streisinger has outlined for you. They run the I-5 corridor, except with the exception of Bend. But there are also urban clusters. And these urban clusters are what are difficult for us in our office, because they define any community that is at least 2,500 people and less than 50,000 people. And all of us know of many, many areas in the state of Oregon that have more than 2,500 people that we would certainly classify as rural. The real weakness in this definition is that it just looks at population and it does not take into account the geographic diversity or the geographic barriers that might exist in a state. And so for our purposes, we did not feel it was very useful. So I'm going to move on to one that you're probably also very familiar with, and this is the Office of Management and Budget. And they describe metropolitan statistical areas. And in Oregon, they also pretty much run the length of the I-5 corridor. In addition, Deschutes County is slated to become a metropolitan statistical area within the next year. The problem with this definition is that it designates an entire county. And there is only one county in Oregon that has no rural community in it, and that is Multnomah County. The most egregious problem with this is probably illustrated by Lane County, which, of course, Eugene is, we would consider that a metropolitan area, but it encompasses all the way from Oak Ridge across the state to Florence, which are certainly rural communities. So this metropolitan statistical area Office of Management and Budget definition is also not very useful for us. And unfortunately, many of the federal programs that give aid to rural areas are based on these definitions of a metropolitan statistical area. This third one is kind of esoteric. It came from the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy and is a modification to the metropolitan statistical area definition, and takes into account, actually this is a modification to the Census Bureau's, and it takes into account some commuting population, people who commute from rural to urban areas. And if more than 15% of the people in a certain group of census tracts commute, 45% of them must travel more than 30 minutes to be eligible. I'm not going to go into all of these because it's really very detailed. But you can see how this works out in terms of the state of Oregon. And it comes probably as close as any of the federal definitions to meeting our needs. But it still doesn't entirely meet our needs, because portions of Columbia, all of Columbia County, portions of Washington, Yamhill, Polk, and also Lane County, and all of Marion County are still designated as MSAs, and they are not allowed to be rural areas. This next one is a really interesting one, and it came from the University of Washington under contract to the Office of Rural Health Policy, And these RUCA codes are rural urban commuting areas. And you would think the people in Washington would be those that we could rely upon to come up with something that would work for the state of Oregon. But this one doesn't work for the state of Oregon either, because it has broad areas that are designated as urban, and it's also based entirely upon commuting patterns and does not take into account the geographic diversity of the state at all, or what geographic barriers might exist. So now I'm going to refer you to the one that our office adopted about 12, 13 years ago, when the legislature enacted a series of initiatives that would benefit rural areas. We realized that we had to define what rural was. And so we looked at all of the available research, and then we decided to just use our intuition and look at Oregon and decide what seemed rural to most of the people that we talked to. And this is what we came up with. The 10 miles from a center of a population center of 30,000 or more. And we use a GIS mapping system now to get the exact centroid, that's the right word, of a population center. And in this case, Representative Anderson, all of Josephine County is rural, so it certainly would be rural from our perspective. When we first began this, Bend was rural as well, but since then has surpassed, way surpassed 30,000 population, so it has fallen outside the definition of rural. And in fact, Albany was also rural when we began and is no longer rural by our definition. We also have exceeded that there are some degrees of being rural, and so we have separated out the frontier counties in the state, and that's a federal definition of six or fewer people per square mile, and those are dark green on your map. And then we also have a category that we call remote rural and less remote rural. I don't believe those are delineated on the map, but it gives you an opportunity to look at some degrees of rurality based on distance and population. And so I hope that this definition will be helpful for the committee and would be workable for House Bill 3630, and I would be certainly glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Whitaker. Mm-hmm. Why don't we hold on questions until we've asked and have Ms. Keene's testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Keene, and I am president of Safe Corporation. The last time this issue was before you in a very highly conceptual way, the chairman of our board of directors was here, John Egge, and he indicated that we had been asked by the governor's office to assist the department in looking for solutions to this portion of the medical malpractice or medical professional liability problem. Our learning curve is behind yours. You've spent a lot of time on the issue, and I'm sure there are a lot of things that the members of the committee know that we don't yet know. However, we believe that the bill as proposed by the department and the Dash 3 amendments provides an appropriate framework for us to contribute to a solution. That contribution would be a reinsurance solution, the details of which we can't possibly finalize yet. We would obviously require the close collaboration both of the department and the primary insurers, and there's every evidence that that would be forthcoming. So I really can't provide you with explicit details on the reinsurance program other than to suggest to you that we believe the bill does give us the framework and the authority and the financial mechanism to participate in this program. And with those caveats, I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you have, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Questions for either Ms. Whitaker or Ms. Keene? Representative Jensen and then Representative Anders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What do we do with a community like Milton Freewater? This is a community which was within 10 miles of a, but it's outside of the state of Oregon. That is the Walla Walla community.
Representative Williams, Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, Milton Freewater is categorized as rural by our definition in Umatilla County. It is in the Walla Walla service area, and certainly many of the people in Milton Freewater seek health care in Walla Walla, but they also might go south, you know, in Umatilla County. So it is rural by our definition.
Mr. Chair, they might go south, but they... I think you'd be hard-pressed to find someone in Milk Freewater who wits out to... I just was curious, Mr. Chair, as to how that would... how that would affect a community of that size, I mean, especially in light of things like obstetrics, where there is no, though it's within the realm of possibility that we might have a physician living in Milk Freewater practicing in Walla Walla.
Yeah, Representative Jensen, Mr. Chair, I think we have not made allowance in this definition for areas that might be across the border in another state, and I suppose we could look at that, but I would be loath to designate Milton Freewater as less than rural. I think the people who live there believe they live in a rural community, so they probably wouldn't care for it if we told them they didn't.
I understand that. No matter what we do with maps, we always have some problems.
It's never perfect, no matter what we do.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Keene, this is a very creative short-term solution. Do you see this as a possibility for a long-term solution within SAFE?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, frankly, our thinking hasn't gone that far. 4 years was a time frame that we looked at. This is a program that is requiring funding that probably can't be sustained permanently, as I understand it from Ms. Streisinger. So I'm not sure that the funding mechanism could be considered a permanent solution. Reinsurance could perhaps be a part of some permanent solution.
Thank you.
Any other questions,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crummell.
I guess I have a couple, if I may.
You may.
First, Dr. Whitaker, one of the things that has been asserted to me in other committees that I've sat on is that in rural areas, not only is malpractice insurance an issue, not only are reimbursement rates an issue, but also the willingness many times of the family of the physician to stay in the area. And actually had it said to me one time that rather than once they know that they've got the physician or the practitioner ready to move there, then they have to move into recruiting the family and recruiting specifically the spouse. And I know that that has been kind of an issue. So how do we overcome some of those issues in addition to the malpractice issue?
Representative Crummell, Mr. Chair, first I want to say thank you for promoting me, but I'm not a doctor, so I'm just an ordinary person. So,
well, so are doctors. They just haven't realized
yeah, that's
it yet.
True. Okay, I won't touch that one. The retention of a physician in a rural community is a really complex situation. And while the surveys that we've done have shown that the lifestyle in a rural community is the overwhelming attraction, there are other issues like access to education for their families and access to a job for the spouse and cultural opportunities, and certainly financial considerations are at the very top of the list, because rural physicians generally make about $20,000 to $30,000 less than their urban counterparts. So when we find a physician and a physician's family who's willing to go practice in a rural community, those are very special people, and we want to treat them really well so that they will stay there.
Okay, thank you. And then, Ms. Keene, relative to the issue of SAFE, doing this as a short term and utilizing part of the premiums that are actually paid by employers for workers' comp type of coverages, have you heard back from many of your subscription holders or your policy holders from a standpoint of whether they think this is a good idea or a bad idea, or, you know, hell no, not with my money, or what have you heard back from them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I'm not sure that our policyholders are widely aware of the specifics of the proposal, and I don't believe that they really have had enough information to form an opinion. However, this is not money that is paid to us in premiums. This is a workers' compensation assessment that, as Ms. Streisinger indicated, all workers' compensation insurers collect and pass through to the department to run part of the department's operations. So it would not affect SAFE Corporation's policyholders uniquely. I can tell you that to the extent we've had any comments, they've been comments directed at making sure that the Industrial Accident Fund is not used for this purpose. And those comments have been both formal and informal and all expressed with vigor and enthusiasm and even vehemence, I might say.
May I? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would you then be actually, if you had a couple of verdicts that went over what the capacity of the reinsurance was, would that then place you in a position of having to utilize reserves for another type of funding mechanism in order to cover those verdicts? If you only have, for example, $10 million sitting there, but you have three verdicts at total $18 million, you're $8 million short by my math, and I'm just wondering how that would be covered.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, in crafting a reinsurance approach to the problem, we would have to make sure that our liability did not exceed the reimbursement available to us, the credit that we would take on the pass-through funds. So that would mean some sort of a layer of reinsurance. The bill is crafted to give us the authority to both buy reinsurance and assume risk ourselves directly. And we may find that some combination of those two approaches would be necessary in order to maintain the limitation on the funding available and to not expose the Industrial Accident Fund to risk. In addition, the bill creates a separate mechanism, a separate fund out of which this business would be transacted as another way of making it clear that the Industrial Accident Fund would not be used inappropriately.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got to come back to the Milton Graywater picture, and for specific reasons, I think. We're talking about some break-in in insurance costs for a doctor in certain areas, obstetrics, whatever the others might be. Would a physician living in Milton Freewater, practicing in Walla Walla, okay, be eligible for insurance under the provisions of or subsidization of their insurance under the provisions of this bill?
Representative Jensen, Mr. Chair, I would think not. The way we describe practice and eligibility for the tax credit, for example, is where that physician practices, not where the physician resides. So I think we could certainly make that clear in rule if it's not clear in the statute that someone who lives in Oregon
feel a lot better about it.
Yeah, and practices somewhere else. We're not in the business of subsidizing premiums for people who practice in out of state. So yeah. I'm sure we wouldn't want that to inadvertently occur. We could make sure that it did not.
It'd be a real boom to
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
A few doctors move into town. But I wanted to make sure and clarify that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Next up, Scott Gallant from the OMA, Bruce Bischoff from the Hospital Association, and Jim Dorrigan from Northwest Physicians Mutual. Why don't we begin with you, Mr. Gallant?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. We have approximately 6,700 members. They are also employers, for those who sometimes forget. We want to, first of all, express our appreciation for the governor's effort to draft a proposal that would provide some breathing room while we figure out a long-term solution to the liability crisis. A recent May 2003 Joint Economic Committee report states a couple of, I think, important things. One is the combination of deteriorating profitability, reduced supply, and structural market changes has created an environment where coverage, liability coverage, can be extremely difficult to obtain and which reduced competition makes significant price increases more common. Moreover, these changes are not merely part of a short-term insurance cycle. And finally, in part it says, in fact, insurers do not exist in an insurance market completely simply due to short-term cycles. They only do so if the long-term outlook is so bleak as to make it continued business operation untenable. The OMA is committed to work with the administration on their proposal to address the immediate crisis in rural Oregon, while we continue to urge the legislature and the administration to redouble its efforts to address what is, in fact, a statewide crisis. According to a recent OMA survey of physicians, almost 18% of all physicians in Oregon have already stopped or definitely will stop providing obstetrical, surgical, high-risk or complex cases, including hospital services and emergency department coverage. The liability crisis in Oregon may be more acute in rural Oregon, particularly since the median age of medical practitioners in rural areas of the state indicates that we have and will continue to have difficulties retaining and recruiting physicians as more rural doctors retire or move to more favorable practice environments. While we applaud the governor's recognition that the state is facing a liability crisis and the legislation addresses a small, targeted population of medical specialties, the OMA believes that the proposal can be enhanced and expanded from impacting approximately 100 to 150 physicians who practice in rural Oregon to over 1,000 physicians who practice in rural Oregon. The OMA concept, which I have provided you, would do the following. It would create a rural medical liability relief fund. It would utilize the same resources and provide the same assurance for employers that the funds would be appropriately returned to SAFE. It would eliminate any possibility of risk exposure to the SAFE Corporation. It would be more easily administered, and it could reduce rural physicians' liability premiums by some 40 to 50%. The proposed bill would also create a new joint interim legislative committee to study all of the options the next legislature might consider in order to address the liability crisis in a comprehensive manner. The proposal would include non-general fund resources to adequately fund a joint legislative committee that would be charged with recommending a solution to the liability crisis in a comprehensive manner. Again, the OMA appreciates the efforts of the Department of Business and Consumer Services, the administration, and the SAFE Corporation. We believe that with the leadership of the Judiciary Committee, and particularly the chair of the committee, that a consensus bill can be developed that temporarily addresses this concern in rural Oregon and allows for a methodical and thoughtful process to address this problem comprehensively. I've also provided you what I did was a quick breakout of the concept of the governor has in the Dash 3 amendments and its impact in Josephine, Lane, Multnomah, Polk, Umatilla, and Washington counties. On the left-hand side of how many physicians might potentially be affected by the governor's proposal, which would be a total of 12 physicians versus the concept that we would suggest be considered as well, which would have an impact of some 272 physicians in the same counties, which I'm sure you're familiar with, all those particular counties, to just provide you with some food for thought. I really don't intend to go through our draft today. We wanted to provide it to the committee as a potential option, and as I said, enhancement to the proposal and approach that the governor has suggested. We look forward to working with the committee. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Galen. We'll go through everybody and then go to the questions. So why don't we go to Mr. Bishop?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. OAHHS supports House Bill 3630 as it is proposed to be amended by the governor. We have not seen the Dash 3 amendments, but based on the insurance commissioner's representation that they're largely the same, we see no reason to not find them acceptable. The Dash 1 amendments that we did review were supported by the association. The bill does not directly affect the liability costs of Oregon hospitals, but it will address the premium costs of some rural physicians. To that extent, and to the extent that the bill encourages rural physicians to stay in practice in their communities, that will be an indirect benefit to the hospitals in which they practice. We believe that the focus of this bill necessarily must be on physicians, but we would ask that the committee consider the possibility of an amendment that would make clear that a hospital should not be held liable for a physician's negligence when the only reason that the hospital would be a co-defendant in a matter is that the physician is practicing at the hospital. And we would be prepared to present an amendment for the committee's consideration in work session to make clear that a hospital wouldn't have derivative liability just because a physician was practicing there. If the physician were an employee of the hospital would be responsible. But just the fact that the hospital is available for the practice should not make the hospital liable for the physician's conduct. With the possibility of consideration of that amendment, however, we would still support the bill as it is proposed to go forward.
Okay. Thank you, Bruce. Mr. Dorgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Dorgan. I'm CEO of Northwest Physicians Mutual Insurance Company. We're a mutual insurance company owned by our physician policyholders. We currently insure 2,130 Oregon physicians. We would like to recognize and appreciate the effort of the governor, the State Accident Insurance Fund, and DCBS, and also their recognition that a problem exists in this area. The problems cited in the bill are the affordability and availability of insurance, and this proposal will address the affordability of insurance for 150 or less Oregon physicians, representing less than 3% of the doctors in the state. The remaining 6,000 plus doctors are not addressed by this proposal. The second part of the issue for physicians and what I hear from physicians when they discontinue high-risk practice is they are concerned about the size of the lawsuits against them. The average obstetrician, whether rural or urban, is sued for $9.5 million. We're talking about a proposal here that will provide a reinsurance protection with a cap of $10 million per year. So it offers a potential premium savings, but does not address the volatility of the malpractice insurance and the concern that physicians have for their personal assets in the event that they're sued. The proposal that Mr. Gallant talked about expands this to all rural physicians and really addresses what the program is, which is a subsidy of premium for physicians. As a reinsurance program with $10 million, it's very difficult really to offer any absolute protection on a reinsurance side because liability is limited, and we do not have the option to limit our liability as a primary carrier, and a reinsurance proposal that offering $10 million of exposure may be better structured as a straight subsidy, reducing the price of insurance for more physicians. Oregonians throughout the state need continued access to their doctors, and unfortunately this only addresses a small percentage of the physicians, with 150 or less being addressed. The second part of the proposal that I'd like to address is the Section 10 of the Dash 3 amendments that talks about the director of the Department of Consumer Business Services studying the options relative to solutions in the state of Oregon. What I would like to see is that this proposal provide adequate funding to hire an independent consultant experienced in actuarial and accounting and legal issues to go in and look at this from an independent point of view and come up with some proposed solutions. I think an independent consultant could look at some of the proposals and solutions that have been tried in other states and come up with some options and kind of rank those in order of priority. The problem with task forces or groups within the state is, as I sat on the governor's task force, is you tend to get very partisan opinions coming to the table, and I'd like to see an independent consultant looking at that and recommending back to the legislature. Finally, I'd like to say that Northwest Physicians Mutual, it will continue to work with SAFE, DCBS, and the governor's office to develop solutions, and if this is something that is passed by the legislature and signed into law, that we will work in order to help physicians in rural areas access insurance and improve their ability to provide care. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dorgan. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just a question to Mr. Gallant. I have read your Dash 2 amendments very quickly, and if I understand it, the funding mechanism here is just an outright grant or contribution or appropriation from SAFE of $10 million into this fund. How does that get paid back?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, the mechanism would be the same. SAFE would still have a credit for the funds that were used up to $10 million, so that would not change. We're using the same mechanism as proposed in the Dash 3 amendments. However, Mr. Chairman, utilizing the funds differently.
I have one follow-up.
Yes, Representative
Ackerman. Have you consulted with the SAFE Corporation to see whether this funding mechanism is within their statutory authority? Now, that's a question I'll ask of the state SAFE representative later, but if you've cleared that, I'd like to know. If not, I'll have to ask it again of the SAFE witness.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, what we tried to do was utilize the same authority as proposed in the Dash 3 amendments proposed by DCBS. To assure that we could, in fact, transfer those funds. The difference is, again, how we utilize the same resources and the number of physicians who would receive premium relief under the proposal.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions of the panel? Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have numbers of people that the Oregon or the American Medical Association offer that you would need to support a OBGYN? If I want to go buy a McDonald's franchise, I mean, they can tell me how many people I have to have in a community in order to have a viable, so how many people do we need to have in order to support one OBGYN?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I'm sure those statistics are available. I don't have them off the top of my head, but it would probably be more generally how many, what size population is necessary in order to support a physician Typically, it would be a family practice physician who also provides obstetrical services. But Ms. Whitaker, I'm sure, has great statistics on the numbers of individuals per physician in the rural areas that are included under their definitions, and I'm sure that can be provided to the committee.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow.
Yes, you may.
I'd be interested in that. I'd also be interested in the numbers for things like a neurosurgeon. As such, how many, or for any of the specialties that we're talking about. And let me be clear, you know, it's to where I'm going with this. I have concerns here that we really aren't addressing the issues of Eastern Oregon, that what we're doing is coming up with a some kind of a medical malpractice insurance slush fund. And I'm not sure that I apologize for that that wording, but for example, I can't think of a community other than perhaps Bend, east of the mountains, that really would have the business, head injury business, necessary to be able to support a neurosurgeon. I mean, my community, Umatilla County, is the most populated county other than the Deschutes Bend area, east of the mountains, and I am sure we would not have, because we have both the benefit of neurosurgeons at Pasco, which is 25 miles away, Cadillac, the Tri-Cities area, 25, 30 miles away from one city, and we have the neurosurgeons in Walla Walla, which is 30 or 35 miles away from the other city where the population is. And if you take either one of those two communities or both of them combined, you just don't have the end there, I don't think.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, we have looked at the rural territory and the physicians and their specialties in the totality of the 1,023 who would, in our version of this approach, would have an be impacted by the proposal. There is one neurosurgeon. And out of the total 1,023, and I believe he is in Douglas County specifically. The Dash 3 amendments, and Dash 1s for that matter, use some terminology that may not really fit. For example, it includes trauma surgery. There's really not a classification that is technically used for that. In rural areas of the state, obviously general surgeons are the primary physician who provides services in emergency room departments for trauma cases there, or if they are significant cases, obviously they typically are transfer to an area that has the appropriate hospital ability and surgical ability to treat head injuries or other neurological surgical problems. But there is a need to really kind of clarify, even under the Dash 3 amendments, the actual practitioners who are really included in the bill, because it's not necessarily clear technically who would be.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, why don't we have Lisa Trussell and J.L. Wilson come forward. And Melanie, is it Sperry? You want to come up? Lisa, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and we're here today to lend our support to the Dash 3 amendments on House Bill 3630. AOI participated in the governor's task force on the medical professional liability crisis in Oregon, and as you've seen in this committee, there's been a number of options discussed about ways to solve the crisis problem, and there's not a whole lot of agreement on those ideas. What we believe this bill will do is it will allow a temporary fix to allow time to develop a permanent solution. And importantly for AOI and our members is that the funding mechanism doesn't use the Industrial Accident Fund. And as was indicated earlier, the premium assessment tax will still be allowed to be reduced. So that concludes my comments.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa. J.L.?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing NFIB. I represent 12,000 employers in the state, about 70% of whom are insured through Safe Corporation. We're supportive of the Dash 3s. Our support was contingent on the funding mechanism, which is the premium assessment. Every premium, workers' comp premium, the state is accompanied by an assessment which goes to fund DCBS and the departments within that. It will be. It is currently 8%. A few years previous, it was 7.3, but it's slated to be 6.7. Our support for the bill is contingent on the fact that it would not compromise the new 6.7 rate due to go into effect, or would not preclude the possibility of further rate reductions if that is the case, and that is why we support the Dash 3 amendments as a temporary solution to this issue.
Thank you, J.L. Ms. Spearing.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Melanie Spearing, and I'm the underwriting manager for CNA Insurance here in the state of Oregon. We currently insure approximately 2,100 physicians in the state. We applaud the governor for his effort to assist certain physicians in Oregon who have been seriously affected by the high cost of medical liability insurance. And we would also like to commend SAFE and DCBS for their involvement as well. Unfortunately, the bill that's proposed does not address the root cause of the problem, the cost of the medical liability system. We believe the problems associated with the Oregon medical liability market are best resolved through enactment of meaningful tort reform. The bill proposes a subsidization to a limited number of physicians and shifts the financial burden for the cost of the medical liability system from one sector of the insurance industry, being the medical liability insurers, to another, which would be SAFE and or reinsurers involved. Much more information is needed to understand with any degree of certainty how the program would work and the issues it would present for medical malpractice insurers. Because of the limited detail available at this time, there are many, many questions that remain unanswered regarding operational and practical questions about the likely success of this proposal. As noted, the proposal would not lower overall system costs, and it could actually increase system costs because of the high friction costs associated with shifting the burden to a new reinsurer. While we believe tort reform is the preferred approach, if the governor and the legislature believe that subsidization of certain health care providers is appropriate, we believe there are alternative mechanisms that could accomplish that objective in a less costly and more effective manner. In fact, we understand there is a precedent for assisting rural physicians with high medical liability insurance costs through subsidies that were less expensive and more direct. What I'm referring to is the states of Texas and Maine. The bill at first glance appears to be fairly simple, but is more complex than meets the eye. To obtain an estimated savings of 50%, SAFE would need to reinsure approximately 50% of the expected losses. Although that sounds easy enough, but although the premiums are known, the losses are not. Additionally, physicians buy varying limits that result in different levels of reinsurance necessary to meet the desired level of a 50% cost savings. Lastly, the proposal limits SAFE's annual reinsurance recoverable to $10 million. That means additional insurance would need to be purchased to ensure that SAFE does not exceed that $10 million cap. That cost would not reduce physicians' premiums, but would be borne by the Industrial Accident Fund. In contrast, a subsidy deals with a known premium and a known amount of subsidy. Any and all money could be used to reduce physicians' premiums and not used to pay for administrative costs or additional reinsurance that are inherent in the governor's proposal. We're concerned about the expansion of SAFE's charter. CNA as a whole is concerned with the expansion of SAFE's charter to include medical liability insurance. SAFE was specifically established to provide workers' compensation insurance to Oregon employers. As a result, SAFE is not an experienced medical liability reinsurer. SAFE will be required to develop or secure expertise to create a detailed plan to limit potential losses to $10 million per year and administer the costs of the new program. Failure to meet this cap of $10 million could jeopardize SAFE solvency and prejudice its workers' compensation policyholders. We do not believe it is appropriate, necessary, or desirable to supplement the reinsurance market with a subsidized government-created reinsurance entity. I say that, however, we are willing to cooperate should the governor, SAFE, DCBS, decide and the legislature approve to continue with this plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Spirin. Are there questions for any of the members of this panel? Ms. Spirin, I'm interested a little more about the detail you mentioned, Texas and Maine. Do you know much about those programs?
I don't have any specific information here with me, but it is something that I can provide for you.
Okay. I think we'd probably want to see that.
Okay.
If you're suggesting that we look at it as a model, we'd like to see what it is. Anything else? Okay, thank you all. Finally, Jack Monroe and John DiLorenzo. Oh, Jack. Kathy, you scare him out?
Everybody.
All right. Well, we'll let you go first, John. Otherwise, we'll just sit quietly and assume 5 minutes of Jack's testimony. There he is. You're up, Jack. I called you up. Just find it. Come up to the table. You don't want to sit next to him. Okay, that's all right. Go ahead.
John, you have way too much time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney with the Davis Wright Tremaine firm, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of my client, Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy, or OSEP for short. You're each being handed a packet of materials. There's a large folder or large notebook, which is really my Senate testimony, which is just for your reference, and I'm not going to take you through all of that. I do have a summary of it as part of my testimony here, and that's the top copy. The OSEP was formed in September of 1997 by many members of the Class Action Steering Committee for what was at the time known as the ABC Roofing and the All-C Veneer cases. Through their efforts, employers in the state received approximately $200 million, representing their share of pre-1982 Industrial Accident Fund surplus accumulations, which had been appropriated for budget relief in 1982. Over the years, OSEP has had a significant interest in the management of the Industrial Accident Fund by SAFE and has on many occasions questioned the manner in which the surplus accumulations are determined and thereafter distributed. Earlier this year, I had the opportunity to testify before the Senate Committee on Transportation and Economic Development concerning the future of SAFE. The hearings generated many proffered methodologies for resolving problems inherent in SAFE and numerous viewpoints concerning the future of SAFE, culminating in a decision by the majority of the committee to begin a process ultimately leading to the sale of SAFE. During those hearings, SAFE's desire to do business as a private company while remaining an agency of the state of Oregon was thoroughly discussed. The committee examined SAFE's agency status and its charge to make inexpensive insurance available to Oregon employers. The committee also heard testimony relating to how SAFE, the state agency, engages in activities which the legislature would never tolerate from any other state agency. In particular, the committee heard testimony that SAFE discriminates among those it was created to serve, that it amasses political data concerning members of the legislature, that it lobbies and retains political consultants, that it attempts to influence the legislature's thinking by appropriating significant proceeds for legislative advertising, for the purpose of influencing legislative opinions. I am appending a full copy of my Senate testimony for your information. It is for many of these reasons that my client has great concerns with respect to the proposed expansion of SAFE's role to the medical malpractice arena. If the governor's proposed amendments are adopted, SAFE will be charged with making many decisions in the absence of any meaningful oversight and in the absence of any opportunity for the public or the legislature to review their decision-making process. For instance, the governor's proposed amendments permit SAFE to offer reinsurance coverage on such terms and conditions as SAFE determines to be reasonable. SAFE is required to develop a plan that does not obligate SAFE to provide coverage at a cost that exceeds an average of $10 million for each policy year for the 4 years in which reinsurance is provided. The cost to SAFE is to be the amount it would cost the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation to reinsure all of its coverage obligations under the plan. In another section, if an insurer reinsures with SAFE, the insurer must reduce premium charge to a physician by an amount equal to the difference between the cost of the reinsurance premium paid to SAFE and the cost of the reinsurance premium that the insurer would have paid to the reinsurer in the private reinsurance market. Well, who makes those determinations? From all appearances, SAFE management and its board of directors makes many of these and other determinations, which will ultimately result in the success or failure of this new enterprise, which is proposed for SAFE Corporation. Unfortunately, there will be no real way to know whether SAFE Corporation is making these determinations in the public interest. That is because SAFE Corporation has a history of refusing to disclose to the public information which the public needs to determine how its own insurance company is being managed and whether there exist surpluses which should otherwise be shared with the policyholders and with the public at large. In February, I wrote to each of you concerning my client's efforts to obtain records and information from SAFE relating to the manner in which dividends are declared, how they are distributed, and other information which would allow employers and the public to determine the true extent of the surpluses available in the Industrial Action Fund. Over the years, SAFE has employed many tactics to resist disclosure of this information. In July of 2000, my client filed a lawsuit in the Circuit Court of Marion County demanding disclosure of many documents which SAFE wished to keep secret. In early 2001, the Marion County Circuit Court ruled that my client was entitled to inspect all the secret documents at issue in under ORS Chapter 656, and furthermore issued a declaratory judgment that the exceptions in the public records law were not applicable to requests made by my client for this type of information. The court was of the view that SAFE could not deny the public records requests or any portion thereof based upon exemptions like trade secrets. Judge Lipscomb's letter decision is appended at tab 11 to my Senate testimony in case you're interested in that. Thereafter, SAFE appealed to the Court of Appeals. And at this point, Mr. Chairman, I would like to briefly depart from my written testimony because I have been informed as of this morning that the Court of Appeals has this morning affirmed the decision of the trial court. In approximately a 15-page ruling, Judge Landau, on behalf of the court, has ruled that all records of the State Accident Insurance Fund mean just that under Chapter 656, and that SAFE may not assert trade secrets or other exemptions to prohibit public inspection of those documents. Now, whether SAFE will seek to a petition for review in the Supreme Court of the Court of Appeals decision or will seek a stay of the mandate is a matter yet to be decided and is within SAFE's power. Recently, though, representatives of SAFE distributed to some of you a document to show how SAFE has performed exactly as the legislature intended during these difficult times. That document was an inter-office memorandum to Ms. Keene, the president and CEO of SAFE, from SAFE's marketing manager, and it generally analyzed market dynamics impacting Oregon's small businesses. Of great interest was the statement at the top of the memorandum, which said, quote, "This memorandum is confidential and exempt from public disclosure." I am attaching a copy of the first page of that document to this testimony. So you can witness firsthand an example of the manner in which SAFE abuses the exemptions of the public records law to keep hidden documents which the public has every right to see. The document which SAFE evidently designated as exempt from disclosure is a fairly innocuous one, generally analyzing market trends, private carrier activity, and SAFE's role vis-a-vis other carriers. A full copy of the document can be made available to you. I'd be pleased to make it available to you should you request it. The document obviously is not the type which should be shielded from the public, not only by virtue of its content, but by virtue of the fact that it had already been supplied to many of you. Public agencies should not be permitted to deprive the public access to their records merely by placing a stamp or a legend on them. If SAFE is entrusted with the provision of reinsurance in the medical malpractice markets, will it likely assert trade secrets in order to keep its source documents and records of its activity in this arena away from public purview? Will SAFE be as unaccountable to you in this new arena as it has been in the workers' compensation arena? Will SAFE be permitted to make new contractual alliances for political purposes without your consent in this arena too? My client does not object to the governor's general approach. In fact, we applaud the governor's approach to relieve the medical malpractice insurance crisis which now faces the state. We do object, however, to entrusting this task to an organization which sometimes operates as a private company when it suits its purpose, sometimes as a state agency when it suits its purpose, and always under the cloak of secrecy. As I stated in my Senate testimony, the time has come for the legislature to decide whether SAFE is fish or fowl. If SAFE is intent upon operating as a private organization, then the state should sell it or mutualize it, and then it should operate accordingly under the insurance code. If, on the other hand, you feel it is to operate as an agency of this state, and if its charge is to be further expanded by virtue of these amendments, then its operations should be conducted in the light of day, and it should cease and desist its attempts to obstruct the public's right to know and cease its efforts to place political pressure upon your decision-making processes. Further amendments guaranteeing oversight, accountability, and public access to information are a must, in our view, if this agency's role is to be further expanded. Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much for your courtesies and the time that you have afforded me, and I am available to answer any questions.
Further questions for Mr. DiLorenzo? Okay, thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Monroe.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Monroe. I'm here today appearing on behalf of the American Insurance Association. My comments will be very brief, therefore there will be nothing under tabs 1 through 11. In my testimony, but at its most fundamental level, this is a relatively simple problem. You have two very experienced Med-Mal carriers that insure much of the market here. In order to make their services and meet their contractual obligations, they have to charge a premium that clearly creates problems and creates an affordability problem for some of their insureds. On the other hand, the proposed solution is to ask a third party that knows nothing about this insurance market to play a role in providing reinsurance at a subsidized rate and really ask the consumers of workers' comp insurance to pay that subsidy. Now, I fully recognize, and we fully recognize, that this is a temporary measure, but I would summarize our concerns in the following way, and I think you've heard those that preceded me expressions of reservation that are consistent with ours. First, this really isn't a solution to the underlying problem. It's a temporary solution that will delay the day of recognizing those more fundamental problems. We would share the reservations that a couple of others have expressed about the issue of whether or not there's an appropriate delivery mechanism here. Unlike others that might be in the building, we, I think, have accepted SAFE's role in the workers' comp market, but we do not think that SAFE Corporation ought to be involved in marketing medical malpractice insurance or any other insurance product in a market that may be experiencing some sort of dislocation. Third concern, I think, goes to simply how this mechanism works. And I have a little bit longer supply line than some of the other people that have resources here, but we're still scratching our heads trying to figure out exactly how this works and whether or not, in fact, the frictional costs involved in providing this kind of program exceed, in some cases, the value. And I think the last area of concern that we might have, and maybe it's not an area of concern, it's simply a question, but and maybe an appropriate question considering the financial information revealed earlier in the day. But clearly, miraculously, we now apparently find $10 million a year in available assessment money that can be used for this subsidy. So I think in summary, those are our reservations. I think we might have serious, I think we might suggest to you that there might be a simpler way to deliver the aid on a temporary basis if, in fact, you decide to do that, and that might be through some kind of direct subsidy mechanism as has been suggested by others. So with those comments, I'd be happy, obviously, to respond to any questions.
All right. Are there questions for Mr. Monroe?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack. Is there anyone else here on House Bill 3630 or the amendments who wishes to come forward to testify? That moment of uncomfortable silence. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there are no others who wish to testify, I'd like to just say a few words. I'm really concerned about some of the, what I guess I'd call indiscretions on the part of the agency that would be handling all of this, and whether it's the high salaries that have been disclosed or some of the contracts that have been written with no public accounting that I know of, and several other issues. I think there's a major need for oversight, if we are in fact going to assign this to SAFE. I was prepared today to add some Dash 2 amendments, but if this bill is going to move today, I would like to do so. I suspect that we probably will not move today with the need for other information that we've been told can come forward. There appears to be, in my estimation, fairly strong support for some type of oversight to be included. And I think what I'll do is withdraw the idea of inserting the Dash 2s today if they are, in fact, added to Senate Bill 869 and negotiated between some of the parties and the governor during this next week. So I would encourage us to close the hearing and wait for a work session.
Okay, thank you, Representative Anderson. It wasn't certainly my intention today to take this issue to work session. I think we've heard some interesting and informative testimony. I think if you're like me, there's probably some areas of inquiry that you feel like you need to make between now and the time that would be reconsidering this issue. I encourage the parties that have testified to provide us that information at their earliest convenience. I do anticipate, committee, that House Bill 3630 will come back up, but could come back up as early as sometime next week. So as committee members, I encourage you to take the voluminous materials that were provided to us today and follow up with the people who testified on the issues that you've got concerns or questions about, and be prepared to address this issue probably sometime next week. Representative Ackerman.
Well, I take seriously the remarks of Representative Anderson, but I don't think we can accomplish or go down the road of malpractice reform and reform SAFE at the same time. I think that SAFE is a vehicle for a very innovative and market-based approach to a partial solution of the medical malpractice problem, and I think that we should keep our focus on that objective.
Anything else from the committee on this issue? Okay. Then we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3630 at this time. And, committee, we're going to stand in sort of an at-ease format for just a couple of minutes. I'd ask committee members to, if you could, keep yourself in the hearing room because I intend to go back to work here in just a minute. But we're at ease. Back on the record, I think we've got Representative Barker back. Okay, here we are. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on 2498 first. Counsel, can you fill us in on this one?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, 2498, if you recall, is the interest rate judgments bill. There are dash three amendments that you should have before you. And essentially what the dash three amendments do is that they leave for judgments that you get on an account of an amount due and payable, usually for a service, at the 9% rate, while also then allowing the judgments that you receive in a personal injury case or some other type of litigation to track the federal funds rate. The reason being, for instance, if I am a service provider, for instance, a doctor, and I have an outstanding, I provide you with services, you haven't paid the bill, and I have an outstanding account with you, typically I'm getting interest on that account at 9%, or some other rate that's in the contractual agreement between us. And if I turn that interest on an account into a judgment, the original version of the bill would have made that judgment suddenly, the interest rate suddenly go down to the federal funds rate, and the dash two amendments would essentially say that a judgment on an account would keep open the interest rate of 9% that you had previously. And I think,
counsel, you're saying dash three is not dash. You just said dash two. I want to make sure.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dash threes. The dash twos and the dash threes are identical, except for the dash twos provided that for a contract, the contract rate would control if it was greater than the 9% rate or the discount rate, and I just made it if there is a rate in the contract, that is the rate that controls, irrespective of whether it's greater than or less than the discount rate. And I think one that keeps the contractual agreement between the parties, which is important for the contract clause of the Constitution, and also it seems like we're talking right now while there's a federal funds rate that's quite low, but you know, in 10 years it could be quite high, in which case, you know, the circumstances might change as to whether you wanted the federal funds rate or the contract rate to apply. So,
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I did sponsor the Dash 3 amendments and accordingly will make the motion to incorporate the Dash 3 amendments within House Bill 2498.
Representative Ackerman has moved the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2498. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I will be supporting the Dash 3s. The one thing in my reading of this, it looks like this rate's going to be set every week based on whatever the Fed thing. I'm just wondering, if not now, but when it gets over to the Senate, if we want to look at maybe having something that's set not as often as every week, and knowing that we have set amount that's there on a into perpetuity right now of 9% against with judgments, possibly once a year on a set date, or every 2 years or something like that. So the courts are not required to repost every week what this rate is. I think it may be a little bit easier and simplistic for people doing the judgments or in small claims or whatever. Well, small claims, I guess, it stays at 9.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrill.
That's fine. I'll support these to get these out into the floor and over to the Senate, but expressing a couple of concerns. One,
I think that the federal funds rate, I do have some concerns about attaching the interest rate to that. That really doesn't represent the cost of borrowing. And it seems to me that if we're going to set a rate in statute, it ought to equate to what a judgment debtor would have to pay to go out and borrow to pay off a judgment. Maybe something tied to prime plus.
Right.
And the other, where this is, I guess if you've, I'm trying to think, if I have a contract, just an agreement between me and my neighbor, we have a handshake agreement for the sale of my lawnmower, and he doesn't pay me, and we haven't provided for an interest rate, then we get the, what is it, 9%? Is that what it goes to?
Currently, under the statute, it's a 9% rate.
But now we'll go to... I noticed it stays at 9% where it's an agreement. Isn't that right? Whereas if he comes over and steals it from me, and I assume for conversion, the judgment rate is 1 point, whatever the federal funds rate is right now.
Again,
I'm happy to move this on, but I think those are things the Senate ought to look at.
Committee, just remember, however, that this rate setting amount is the rate that you would set if the neighbor who stole your lawnmower wasn't your neighbor, but somebody who had stole it from the state of California, and you were required or did choose to sue him in federal court. This would be the federal interest rate that would be applied to the judgment you would get against him in federal court. So, I mean, we're trying to tie this essentially to the same mechanism that's used in the federal court. And as I understand it, this is, in fact, the mechanism by which the federal court sets the interest rates on judgments in federal court. So I guess to a certain degree, there is a symmetry of how someone with a judgment in the state of Oregon, be it a federal judgment or a state judgment, would determine what the interest rate on the judgment was if it wasn't otherwise established in contract. Representative Pozanski.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, the other thing, hearing Representative Shutterly use an example that dealt with crime, I think that's going to be different because that would be restitution. And I would assume that I think the court has a different... I'm not sure exactly what
it's just a civil
action. Yeah, no, I'm assuming that I couldn't get the DA to prosecute the theft of my lawnmower, so I'm going to sue him in small claims court or something like that.
Okay.
So.
Right. Representative Ackerman, did you have anything to add?
Just, Mr. Chair, I think I recognize that they're trying to keep the 9% rate for most accounts. Most of these sums are small, and if a collector or a creditor has to weekly calculate interest, I just don't think it's going to be efficient for that person to do that. So essentially, they may end up just waiving interest, which they would otherwise be entitled to. So my purpose was to preserve those types of claims and judgments at the rate which is now lawful.
Okay. Anybody else? Comments on the motion to... was the motion to adopt the Dash 3s? I believe it was. Anything else? Is there any objection? Okay, the Dash 3s are adopted. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, so Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2498, as amended, be forwarded to the House with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves House Bill 2498, as amended, be sent to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Okay, Nancy, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2498 moves to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Representative Ackerman to carry. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2494. Council?
Thank you, members of the committee and Mr. Chairman. You should have before you Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2494. If you recall, this bill requires the disclosure of expert witnesses in civil litigation. As you recall, the last time we heard this bill, there were some general concerns about the supplemental notice requirement and whether that was essentially a way out of the requirements of the bill so that last everybody could just say they didn't realize they needed an expert until the last minute and disclose that expert at the last minute. And clearly that wasn't the intent of the supplemental notice provision, which actually is the same provision that's in the federal rules, as I understand it. We have tried to modify the original Dash 1 amendments, which were testified on previously, to make it clear that in the case where an additional expert is discovered late in the game, the proper way to get that expert in would be through Section B2, which is on page 1 at the bottom. It's the last section, starting on line 16. Essentially, this is modification of the rules by the court, and a party would have to show good cause, essentially, that they could not have anticipated the need for the expert in question at the time disclosure was required, before they could bring in a later discovered expert. Of course, there would be situations where this would arise, where your current expert suddenly becomes unavailable due to illness or a conflict, or whether a new issue is brought up, such as a new aspect of damages, for instance, loss of income, where you might need an economist to come in, and that wasn't something you were aware of before. Area would be a punitive damages case where you're going to need an economist to testify on the amount of appropriate punitive damages with respect to the size of the company or the person's wealth that the damages are being sought against. So we also, as further clarification, if you look on page 2 in subsection D, starting on line 10, this deals with the supplemental notice requirement. The supplemental notice requirement was intended for situations where you, for instance, give the expert's address and that address is changed in the time since the disclosure, or the expert testifies in an additional trial that you were unaware of or has a degree that you forgot to mention. That's the type of thing that a supplemental notice would be appropriate for. We have put language in that section clearly indicating that supplemental notices themselves are not to be used to disclose after discovered experts. That would only be appropriate under Section B2 on page 1. Those are the major revisions between the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s.
Are there any questions by the committee of counsel on these amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
On page 1, line 12, sub C of B1 talks about disclosing compensation to be paid, etc. Why is compensation necessary, or what was the thought of including that in the discovery of who your witness is going to be?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Przanski, it was the feeling that compensation was important because it relates to bias and how much an expert is being paid for their testimony. And so that would be something that we would want revealed. And originally, the intent behind this section was that clearly the parties that were seeking such expert disclosure wanted to get certain types of information. For instance, the name would lead you inevitably to, it's my understanding, what I've been told is that if they had the name of the person, they would know essentially what they're anticipated to testify about. They would know essentially what other cases, they'd be able to find through certain databases what cases they testified in, what kind of rates they charged for their testimony. And rather than play kind of a hide the ball and make people investigate and find out this information, it seemed to be more upfront to just say, if this is the information they want, let's just require that it be out there. If they say they can find it pretty easily, let's just, instead of hiding the ball, just get the information out there. And that was the intent of including these certain items, including compensation. We didn't put in here a section that would require them to list the things they're going to testify about, because it seemed that would just open up endless motion practice with respect to these notices. And again, I will remind the committee that in the sanction section at the end of page 2, the sanction for non-disclosure is keeping the witness out, but the sanction for leaving out some information, for instance, the correct address or forgetting to put in a case that they testified in, is simply requiring supplemental notice with that information. We didn't want to leave a sanction of keeping the expert testimony out for failure to provide the proper address, because it seemed like that would just lead to, again, endless motion practice on whether the disclosure of things like address and qualifications was adequate and proper and full under the rule.
Are there any other questions about the amendment? Okay. Chair would move the adoption of the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2494. Discussion? Okay. Nancy, we're probably going to want to call the roll on this.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Parker?
Aye.
Jensen?
No.
Crummel?
Aye.
McPherson?
No.
Kozanski?
No.
Chatterley?
Dash 2 amendment on 2494.
What do you need?
The vote.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2494, Dash 2 amendment is adopted. Chair would move House Bill 2494 to the floor with a due pass, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Okay, Nancy.
Mr. Chair, just to say, yes. Having missed this hearing, the discussion on the amendment, my vote today will be a courtesy vote, just since I don't know.
Okay. Nancy?
Aye.
Anderson?
No. Aye.
Jensen?
No.
Crummel?
Aye.
McPherson?
No.
Kozanski?
No.
Chatterley?
Aye.
Aye. Article 2494, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll sign myself as carrier. And that concludes our business for the day. The committee stands adjourned.